I am impelled not to squeak like a grateful and frightened mouse,
but to roar.
This is
the Grimcast.
Sup, girl?
Hi.
Hi. Let's answer some fan questions. I'm so excited for these fan questions.
Me too.
Hello, this is Rebecca. I just want to say that your show got me through 2020 quarantine, so thank you for that. Question, do you feel like you knew the direction the show was going from season one, or did the ideas just kind of come to you guys as the show went on?
This is a great question. Nobody knew. We were not given any information beyond probably one episode ahead, two episodes ahead.
Rebecca, we were essentially you on the show.
Right.
Moment to moment, not knowing what's happening until we get that next script. And you know what? It was hard for me because I came from the feature world mostly up until this point. So I was very accustomed to a beginning, a middle, and an end, and actually being very much in charge of my arc as the actor on the show, right? And it was a transition for me when I joined Grimm to really give over to zero control and the unknown. And I kind of resisted it for a few episodes. I was sort of struggling a little bit with finding my footing. And then once I just accepted that it was just like real life, where you don't know what you're going to be doing later that day, then I really gave over to it. But we really didn't have much info.
Yeah. I mean, it helps in some ways because your reactions to things are very pure. And the only thing then is you're always shooting out of order. So you kind of need to know where you've been in the last scene that you probably haven't yet shot. But yeah, as far as where our arcs were going, we would see Jim or David or Lynn and they'd go, "Oh, just wait. Oh, we got something good for you coming up. Just you wait." And then be like, what? You'll see.
And we have to remember, this is a fantasy show. So that could be like, just you wait. You're going to have 3 heads. Just you wait.
You're going to die.
I think that's what we were always afraid of.
Definitely the biggest concern for the actor is, am I going to die?
Yeah.
I would love to know what your favorite costume or props were from the show and if you happen to take any of them home with you.
Well, Brie has taken
a lot.
Stolen. Some props from the show.
I have like a circle/ black and white Xerox of my face probably in headquarters. But I'm going to tell you, I actually have them right here in my office I'm in. And I asked for this one because this one was major. But I was able to take the open closed sign from the spice shop.
Oh, that's a good one. There is a dress that I wanted to take, which I was not allowed to take. There's a black and white dress with Prince Eric. It's when I'm in one of his studies, and it's like black on one side and white on the other with this little ruffle sort of thing. But my favorite prop, this was not my favorite prop at the time, but now looking back, I will never, I'm sure, get to do this again, but was holding a pig. There's a baby pig that I get to hold season
3-ish, 4-ish.
Did you want to take that pig home?
That was a cute pig.
It wasn't the rat.
No, although they were gentle. But I was pregnant at the time, and I remember nobody knew I was pregnant and holding the pig. And I can't remember if there were any pig-borne illnesses that I'm supposed to be worried about. It was fine.
I stole this one as a wrap gift for Silas. There was a piece of scrap paper pinned at the register of the spice shop that was there from the first episode to the last.
Oh.
And it said, "Buckwheat, Autumn Thorn."
Whoa.
And I took this scrap piece of paper and I framed it and I gave it to Silas as a wrap gift.
That lasted the whole, that's pretty impressive.
That's cool, huh?
That wins, yeah.
I was wondering how many people were working on the set, like with makeup artists or sound assistants, etc. And I was wondering also, did you have any possibility to decide about your outfits?
I know this, or I did know this at one point. You know, whenever you would get a cart or get snacks or like a coffee cart and you have to know how many people.
Uh-huh.
I think it was about 160 people on set. Does that seem right or does that seem crazy?
No, that seems right.
Maybe that included stages and the office, the production office. It's way more than you think, though. I just always remember thinking like that is way more people.
You do feel like you're only seeing the same 20 people.
Yeah.
There are so many people that are doing so many jobs that you don't see.
Hair and makeup is like 7. On-set dressers, there's 3 or 4. Camera department is like 8.
I honestly think it might be more than 160 if you're going to go to like production offices.
Yeah. We always had at least 2 cameras, 2 full camera crews, grip and electric. I think 160 was with the production office.
Mm, okay. And then in terms of outfit choices, you're going to learn a lot about that today with our special guest. But short answer is yes, there was a lot of collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're a guest star and you're like just coming in for one, there's probably less just because you're just fitting in to something. But when you're developing a character like this for a long-running series, like you got to work together with your costume designer and it makes it fun.
We are talking about Grimm episode 109 of Mouse and Man.
Mouse and Man. Love that title. While investigating a gruesome homicide, Nick learns that a seemingly mild-mannered resident could be festering a potential monster created from a dark childhood. Meanwhile, Monroe is sent an unsettling message by the creature community, who are beginning to wonder if his priorities lie with them or the Grimm.
This episode had so many twists and turns that I really did not see coming.
I legitimately did not know what was going on. I was legitimately like watching the show filled with mystery, filled with intrigue, did not know what was going on. Did not know the killer. Didn't see that.
No. And like there was a little misdirect. It was like, no, well, it can't be Marty. They're already showing us Marty. Clearly it can't be. No. And then the thing with him turning into his father, like, yeah, the psychodrama and also the testosterone drama. The lawyer, so that is also a theme, I guess, that we're coming back to is these evil lawyers, the Lausenschlange.
What is this saying about evil lawyers of the world?
I know.
He had a very like Neil LaBue quality, that guy, you know? He was like, I'm a dick.
No, he was just like dick forward with his red mustache.
No, I love this episode.
And our friend Amanda Walsh. I love Amanda Walsh so much.
And she was great.
She's just a great girl. You know, we used to audition. I mean, our faces are similar. We throw off a similar vibe. But we would be in every audition room together. And then we finally said hi or like introduced ourselves. She dated a guy for a long time who was best friends with someone I was dating or like had dated him before. Yeah. I don't know. There was like that kind of gossipy. She's great.
She was great. The only note I have is in the interrogation that she was so upset, but yet her hair was like flawless, like not a hair out of place. And sorry, hair and makeup. I was like, what's going on there?
No, it was like she had the perfect little curtain bang right there.
Yeah, she did. And that was the scene where I was like, she has Claire's hair because you know how obsessed I am with your hair. And she also has a beautiful head of hair. And I was like, that looks like Claire's hair. And then I started to reflect on my own thinning hair, and I get sad.
No, don't do that. I'll send you some supplements that don't work, and you can spend all your money on those like I've been doing.
Oh, okay, good. But I love this episode so much. I thought it was actually, I'm going to say, one of my favorites so far, next to the pilot. Like, I actually thought it was a really, really great episode. And I, like I said, didn't see a lot of this coming.
And then Monroe getting captured.
You know what I said out loud? Monroe, no! Monroe, no! Monroe, no. Oh, no.
And then it started my favorite line of the episode of Silas going, I got a gig.
He got a watch gig. He's got to go. Those watch gigs don't wait. You know what I like about this? I wrote this down. The theme, loneliness. Loneliness was the thing for me.
That was the undercurrent.
That was my thesis statement for my paper I'm writing on this episode I'll be turning in. First of all, I got legit emotional about our little mouse hurts, trauma, childhood trauma, and his mental health, and that he was seeing his father. That really affected me. And it was really sad. He was just lonely. I love the moment of Nick seeing, probably for the first time in the series, when, you know, Nick had him gunpoint, you know, jig is up, kid. And he's like repeating, I'm just so lonely. No one sees me. No one knows me. I can't remember exactly what he said.
Yeah.
But Nick's face, the realization of actually what a isolating experience it is to be a Vesson. you know, that you are hiding in this world and no one can ever really know who you are.
Yeah.
And I really got that. And I saw it on Nick's face. There were so many little like breadcrumbs. Everything started to connect at the end, like Nick with Juliet when they were hugging. Also, loneliness for Nick.
I know.
Because guess what? He cannot tell his love.
He can't tell her his truth.
Everyone is hiding their truth in this episode.
And Juliet. Bitsy going to the woman's house and then taking all of her kids inside looking out the window.
Oh, God.
Did you laugh when he's like this? I was like, you can't tell Bitsy Tellick what to do. When he's like, stay inside. And she like comes out. He's like,
she's just like,
stay inside. Like, I'm coming out.
No.
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm not going to do that.
No.
Yeah. The thing with the little kid getting berated at dinner.
Yeah.
It was so sad.
But I think Alexander will tell us is that she made a very concerted effort to make the costumes of the people of the murder victims distinct, because we don't know as viewers what the hell is going on when we see this old man. I really did think.
Look at my note. WTF.
Was there a spell or like a aging lesson?
That's what I said. WTF.
Yeah. Yeah. W. Bree has written WTF.
The next thing I wrote was,
not okay.
The screwdriver, not okay. That was really violent.
Not okay. It was not okay. Oh, the one thing, the note I have is, stages so stagey. For the, when they're going out of their house, Nick and Juliet's house. I mean, this is also only because we just all spent so much time there. But when they get outside their house and it's so clearly the soundstage.
But Greens has done a great job.
But that fan was working really well.
The fan was working really well,
like a gentle fan.
A gentle breeze that was blowing Bitsy's hair. And Greens, again, will continue to promote the Greens department because I feel like it is a much ignored department on a film set. Greens is really doing their best, but this takes me back to my soap opera days of just trees being carted in. Trees on rollers.
Gotta get a fir. Can we get a ficus over here?
Yeah.
Get one ficus.
Yeah.
Thank you.
None of that was actually outside, everyone. That was all at the stages where there was probably a cart of cold brew. 50 feet off.
And oh, man. Do you remember that? Like, it came down like high up on the ladder to remove the cold brew from set because we were all getting really weird. They actually banned it from set.
We had kegs of Stumptown cold brew. It wasn't offset during this scene because I feel like that was season three. It was like after.
Oh, yeah. No, it was later. It was like season three.
Yeah.
So our guest today is the reason behind both our beautiful looks and our Vesson identities.
Alexandra Welker was our costume designer from episode 108, which is Game Ogre, until the end of the series. And it's just such an incredible talent and, I mean, one of the best humans on the planet.
One of the best human first, talent second. She's a huge, huge heart. I can't wait to see her. Oh, my
Hi.
God.
Hi.
I have to say, as I was going back and starting to rewatch episodes, oh, and my kids, we haven't started watching, but they're like, we can finally watch it, right? So they're super excited. But I was thinking about our time together was so incredibly meaningful to me. And I thought about all the life passage stuff that went on. I mean, you guys had children.
Yep.
Bitsy and I found love. I mean, a lot of people had life-changing experiences through the process of, well, I guess everybody found love one way or another.
Yeah, so many legal unions.
Yes, so many. Yes, so many dependents born to the insurance plan.
Yes.
But, you know, it's like, other than maybe the sound guy who's miking you underneath your jackets and like right up in your face, there's no more intimate experience that you have on a set than with the costume designer when you're in there for your hours of fittings. And you just, Alexandra, get to know us on such an intimate level.
Then my lips are sealed.
A naked level, but also, you know, there's so much stuff going on. Like, I've gained weight, I've lost weight. It's like going to your hairdresser, it turns into like a therapy session, you know?
Oh, it's mental minefield.
Yes.
Yeah. I still have this picture, Alexandra, you will maybe remember of, we were doing a fitting at the beginning of the season and I had to wear the pregnancy suit because Adeline was still pregnant. I had just given birth.
And there's a picture of me in my nudes with the pregnancy suit with my new baby, like nursing Calvin on top of the fake pregnancy belly.
Absolutely.
It's so good.
That is so funny, Claire. I would love to see that picture.
Yeah. It was also funny for me to go back and watch this episode because the two of you are so much a part of my grim memories and grim experience and everything else. And I was like, oh my God. I mean, Claire, you were in the show already, but you weren't in this episode. So you and I didn't interact at all.
Yeah.
And Brie, you weren't even.
I was just a spark in your eye, a gleam in the future. No, I wasn't even there. I didn't realize, Alexandra, I thought we were closer as newbies together because I started episode 15. I thought you were right around then. I didn't realize you were all the way back to 8 and 9.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us how you got the call because, you know, you were coming on after the show had been established. And so, like, walk us through the process of coming on and then also kind of reestablishing with your particular eye.
Yeah. So, you know, it was interesting. I was actually the third costume designer to get involved with Grimm. And I was thinking about that. And I have made this comparison before, but I've often said that as a creative in the film and television industry, job hunting is a lot like dating. So, you know, we all come in with good skill sets. And then it's really, in the end, so much of it comes down to chemistry. So the two people who've been on board before me had super solid costume design chops, but for whatever reason, the chemistry with our writers and producers wasn't there. And because I had strong ties to Portland, even though I was LA-based at the time, I started getting calls from other friends who were involved with the show. So after the pilot, they decided that, lovely as she was, they weren't going to ask the pilot designer back because, again, the creative juju wasn't the right fit. And I got calls and I said, oh, no, I'm making a movie. Thanks so much. I'd love to work in Portland. I'd love to work with you guys. Not available. And then the season started. And again, the creative juices weren't gelling the right way. And I started getting calls from friends saying, we think that there might be a change coming. We'd love to throw your name into the hat. And I honestly had just come back from an extended trip to Europe.
Yes.
I'd been in the south of France and in London, and I looked at my bank balance.
You know what? A very legitimate and motivating factor.
But the other thing that was funny is that at the time, every year I was coming to Portland in the fall because as a East Coaster living in LA, I really, really would miss autumn and the trees changing and sweater weather and, you know, hot mulled cider and all that kind of stuff. And I have really dear friends who live in Portland.
Yes.
Who named their son after me. And so we had this annual tradition that I would come and spend a long weekend with them and get to do Halloween stuff. And I had just booked that trip and Bert called me.
Wow.
And was like, I'd like you to interview for this show. And I had an interview with him that was great. And one of the things that we talked about was the Portland of it all and how Grimm really wanted Portland to kind of be a character in the show because the flavor of it just really kind of tied into the kind of story that we were trying to tell. And then I had to go meet Bruce Evans at Universal, which was great. But I called my friend to talk about the weekend plans. And I remember vividly saying to him, you know, I'm coming up sooner, I think.
Wow.
And I'm probably staying longer. And I'm not sure if I'm going to see any of you at all. And sure enough.
It must be so bizarre to know that, yeah, like you go from kind of, I'm going to take on this job and a beginning and an end to this thing that is like, oh, I'm just going to be working 24 hours a day now for
6.5 years. Because you were mostly features, right?
I had been doing mostly features. I had done the pilot and the first year of the OC and did all sorts of cool fashion stuff. And I'd done, you know, a little TV here and there otherwise, but not a lot. And yeah, I was doing features. Of course, when I joined Grimm, we only had an order for 13. And so it was super exciting. I think it was maybe 2 or 3 episodes after I got there and we suddenly got the news that we got the back 9, you know?
Yeah.
So that was super exciting. And then I know Brie will remember this and Claire, you probably will too, that we hadn't even finished the 22 when they suddenly gave us a pickup
for season 2
for the next full season. And it was like, Oh, and by the way, we're going to start early.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, we only had like less than a month or something.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So that was really crazy.
Well, especially for pre-production elements such as yourself, like talent hiatus, it's like,
peace out.
Yeah. You know, then you go and then maybe like 3-4 days before start, you kind of come out from your hiatus coma. But when you're prepping, such as with your position, like, what is your hiatus, especially something as short as that?
I mean, it's still a nice chunk. Uh-huh. I won't lie. But yeah, we definitely would come back sooner than you guys at the start of each season and have sort of a month or 3 weeks or whatever it was to dust off the closet, yeah, see what was still working, get out there and find new things, you know, sink our teeth into the first few scripts to have a sense of where the story was going. And then hit the ground running to get ready for all of you to come in.
Oh, my God. Alexandra, do you remember that giant plaid blanket you fashioned into a shirt for me? I mean, this is in season 2, like super pregnant. And like your thought, you were so sweet. You always were like the most loving, the most positive. You never got flustered, never got stressed. But you're also like a stone cold killer. Like you're going to take it to the mat of things that you believe in. And you're very discerning, but you also just allow the human to kind of like go through the weirdness of like a wardrobe journey. Mm-hmm. But I remember you saying the big blanket, this was in that.
The picnic.
No, it was the picnic. The porcupine attacks me and then I make out with Monroe and I'm all like loopied up. But I was like, Alexandra, no. Like,
right.
I look so pregnant. Like you can't, like, you're like, no. You look really good.
It's gonna be fine.
You like pop my collar. I look like a giant semi-truck, like, coming through. And, like, the pattern was, like, it was on camera, actually. Very good. It kind of hid the big ball I had rolling around. It was so funny.
It also helped sell your stunt person. I think we probably had the conversation about the bank robber with the fake mustache, where I was like, you know, the bank robber who comes in with the fake mustache, and then all the eyewitnesses, all they can talk about is this giant mustache, even though they know it's not real. And I was like, the big pattern, because ordinarily I would never do something that big on camera because it's too crazy. But it was a very Pendleton kind of Pacific Northwest thing. And also there, it was like, people will look at that rather than looking at
so smart.
I mean, we just have to say, you know, if you haven't been on a TV film set, what you are tasked with doing, or I should say kind of the parameters and the challenges that you have to first wade into before you even get to what it looks like, you know, especially in Portland where it's like, it's going to be really freezing. There might be rain. This character is going to be running. Also, they're morphing. We need 7 versions of this. Just the layer upon layer of challenge that you have to get through before you can even sort of make stylistic decisions.
Create character decisions.
And I mean, costume design in general is always working on lots of different levels. So, you know, there's always the first level of storytelling. The clothes are helping explain who the character is in a limited amount of time. And in the best possible scenario, they're helping the actor find that character and be supported in that character and inhabit the character. Mm-hmm. The very equally important other level is I'm dressing human beings. So you guys have to not only feel like, oh, this is helping with my character, but also, am I comfortable going on camera in this? Like, are my shoes pinching? Do these jeans make my ass look terrible? You know, whatever it is, like, that's all got to work.
Yeah.
And then there's everything, Claire, you were just touching on. There's the stunts. There's the visual effects. There's the crazy special effects makeup. I mean, Grimm had all of that in spades. And then the actual stories themselves were so much fun because I was designing creatures and Krampus and all sorts of things.
Oh, my gosh.
And you're getting 3 days. I mean, just like the other thing, too, is, you know, from the actor's perspective, when you get booked on a job, the first person you hear from is the wardrobe department.
Right.
I need your sizes because then they need to shop and start prepping because you're probably going to have to be on set tomorrow. And someone has to get this rolling, and you've only just been hired. And so you are really the entry point, you know, for all of us. And then even like having been on the show for a while and as characters are evolving, for me, I just remember like working with you was the first time I really learned about tailoring and then also how to assert my own needs, you know, because it doesn't help you if I'm not able to say like, I don't feel comfortable in this.
Oh, absolutely.
And I was watching Game Ogre, the one that you come on board and then some episodes after. And I just remember like all of my suits and all of my skirts and all of the things that now when I get booked on a job and it's like, oh gosh, like I will never look as good as I looked on Grimm because of you. No, like really, really because of you and your subtle way that you were just like, I'm just going to do this one thing. And then you see it on camera and it's like, oh my God, it just makes such a huge difference. And it's like, there are some things that I am only real.
Well, thank you.
We're so flooded right now, right, Claire? Like, I'm actually in real time just filled with love and also just a deep, deep collaborative respect.
Yeah.
Of like, we really work together on this role. I mean, our roles with you to create these characters. I mean, the audience doesn't even realize what an important part costume design is. And if you get the right combination of actors, you know, which we all work together with you.
It is.
Sure, we had our off days, you know.
Everybody does.
But I think we all really enjoyed the process on this. I know for me, a lot of my entry with my work is in my clothing because even just my footwear is like a very key, key start. You know, it's like foundational when I'm building a character. Like I kind of start on the feet. And for Rosalie, the footwear, honestly, it had to be solid. It had to be grounded. It had to have like a nice soul, you know, a nice Vibram soul, you know. And all those things are like a part of Rosalie's entire constitution. Or like when Adeline, in the beginning of this, you know, with your heels and your suits, like what an evolution you had, Claire.
The shoes. Oh my gosh. I just remember Adeline's specific recipe was like an H&M suit with Jimmy Choo's or like the Louis Vuitton with H&M. It was just what worked. It was like really honestly like this works best on your body, but we're going to give you these killer shoes.
I have to share, I loved one of the earliest combinations like that. There was a scene where you were meeting the captain at the museum.
Yes. I just watched this scene, actually. I know.
Exactly. Oh my God. And Rob, our lovely director. So I basically blew the budget on your shoes. And then you had this fantastic looking little H&M suit that I could just afford on top of the shoes. Because, of course, a part of costume design and television and film is also, you know, working with a budget. And I just was like, the shoes make the outfit. I don't care. And my costume supervisor, bless her heart, was trying to help me. And she was like, oh, I don't think we should spend the money on the shoes. It's TV. No one ever sees shoes, blah, blah, blah. Well, Rob, a self-described shoe whore, I learned. I didn't know that. But he then embraced me and said, thank you for those shoes. I'm changing my shot. And he did that long tracking shot that started on your and went up your body and followed you down the hall and the silhouette and everything. It was like, oh,
see, that is so good.
Which, by the way, that kind of became an Adeline's trademark. It's like you see the shoes and you see her walking and it's this kind of foreboding. Oh, no, here she comes again. Mm-hmm.
Sexy and powerful.
Because you know what? If you had a, you know, nothing against Payless, but you had a Payless pump on, that's not the character. The character is ambitious and stone cold at this phase. I mean, if you know, you know, right, with the shoes. And like those are details that I think a lot of, you know, just because you're moving so fast on network television, it's easy to overlook, but it's the details.
They're also more comfortable, which you also taught me. Like some of these shoes, which costs hundreds of dollars more than you think they should, be like, oh, but the craftsmanship, you know, I'm actually at the end of the day, my feet are more comfortable than they would have
turns
been.
Turns a price per wear situation.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, what I loved is I loved both of your characters so much. And one of the things I loved is that you were such different people, you know, such different characters that we could explore lots of different things in the same show. And so, I mean, Rosalie was kind of Portland personified.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In many ways, you know, the color palette, the labels we were embracing, you know, Filth and Pendleton and Will Leather and Danner Boots and, you know, all of these fantastic things that were made locally. And of course, at the time that we started Grimm, 2011, that's really when I like to think that the Portlandization of the fashionable world kind of happened. Like we were doing things in Portland. Yeah. And then I went home to New York to visit and I was in Williamsburg and I'm like, oh my God, that boutique could be, you know, on Northwest 23rd. It's all
that's
Portland
so
style.
Funny.
And then like a year later in LA, my friends are like, oh, I discovered this great new shop and it's selling these really cool clothes. And I'm like, we've been doing that for.
I know. I had a little bit of like when we moved back and all those stores like Will or, you know, Blue Star, so many that were like in Venice, you know.
I know.
Salt and Straw. Oh my God, Salt and Straw even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you, Alexandra, like what's your process when you kind of start like a big monster job like this where you really know you're going to have to have a Bible? Like, do you go and walk around and just observe? Like, how do you get your mojo going?
First and foremost, I've always been a people watcher and a storyteller myself. And so I love people watching and then trying to figure out who they are based on how they present themselves. So the great thing, again, that made Grimm so much fun for so long was that we had both the normal world, which we were trying to be as realistic as possible in presenting, because then that pulls people into the story and, you know, teaches them about our world and so forth. But then we also had the fantasy weird creature world. And it's kind of interesting because there are many different kinds of costume designers. And a lot of what happens in television, because they're contemporary stories and because the production pace is so rapid, they're primarily shopping shows. And shopping is obviously a huge part of what we did and a very important part. But I also have the experience as a designer where I've done a lot of original designs for things, and I've done a lot of weird comedy movies and other things. So I'm used to designing like an avocado suit for someone to wear and look like an avocado, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I've also done a lot of shows where I've had to do body padding, and I just sort of taught myself how to do that. So you can transform someone by transforming their body. And that was something that came in handy on Grimm, especially when we had stuntmen doubling for female actors.
Yeah.
That was really fun. But that's a whole other story. But yeah, so coming into this, it was very much familiarizing myself with the characters, talking in depth with our show creators and writers about who our characters were and kind of where they were going. Like, they didn't want to tell me too much in advance because, you know, it was still being written, and also they're keeping their cards fairly close, which is typical, but very cool. But enough so that I had a sense of where we needed to go. And then it's really just how do I translate that into the clothes and make it work? I do remember one of the biggest battles that I was constantly fighting the first season, especially with our bad guys, is that I kept getting the directive to put them in black clothing. I mean, ordinarily, black is tough and black is bad. And certainly as a Hex and Beast Claire, you were very monochromatic. That was a big thing. It was all black, gray, and white with the very occasional blood red little touch. But we did so much of our shooting at night, and I would have these discussions, and I'd be like, I can't put everybody in black because, you know, you're going to see their eyes.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of an interest. So then it was all about finding textured black that we could light somehow. So that was kind of fun. It's funny, too, talking about your giant blanket coat, just circling back to that, or blanket cardigan.
Oh, my God. A lot of cardigans. I mean, I actually, as we all did, I tried to take, although I think we had to buy them from NBC.
Yeah, and NBC would not give me, do you remember Alexander the dress? Like, my favorite dress. Was like, no.
The coat I really wanted, because I had to pare it down, was the Madewell, and it has a hood. I think it was in season 5.
Oh, yes.
Is it the gray one?
No, it's a...
It's a parka with a fur.
It has, like, faux black inside in a hood, but inside it says Rosalie 1 of 7. Oh, you know what, it was the finale because there were so many stunts.
Absolutely. Oh, oh my God, I was just like, throw everything at the camera.
Yeah.
Stuntmen, stuntwomen, stunts.
I remember that episode, speaking of being a designer as well, and the fact that they didn't even know the gold they had in you when they brought you on. I mean, with all the fantastical kind of opportunity you had with the show, I remember specifically the wardrobe office and room nearby the stages when I did that steampunk circus episode.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I designed all of the circus characters.
Yeah.
Somebody came in. I thought it was you, but it might have been somebody else. It was like 11 o'clock at night on a Friday, as it always was. And I had my entire crew cross-legged on the floor of my office. We were making steampunk jewelry.
Oh, yeah.
For the ringmaster and the sideshow guy and everybody to wear. And again, because of stunts, we needed multiples. And so I had everybody sitting on the floor, like gluing watch parts and filigree roses and all this kind of stuff. as well as doing all the costume. I think we must have made 7 of your costume, Bree, as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because you wore it, and then the other actress, you know, there was that whole handing off of the circus character.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And you had such an incredible team.
I was just about to say, yeah, I loved going for fittings. I loved being in that room. I loved hanging out.
That tiny airless room.
The tiny airless room.
Yeah, I mean, that goes to show which is sort of disgusting that entire building was. Another, like, I'll throw all these pictures up, but there's a picture of Calvin hanging out with Bot and just like all
the girls.
Oh my God. And I'm like, oh
totally.
My God.
So much fun. Remember we reenacted Stella when I was very early pregnant and Stella was a toddler and she was holding my leg.
She would come to fittings. She's so cute.
And like these pictures are so meaningful and you printed them out and sent them to me. You put them in my trailer and there were 7 in a row. And then at the very end, when Dean was about the same age, we reenacted it with Dean in the same kind of position in the room.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. A lot of magic happened in that tiny airless room.
The tiny airless.
And then also because nobody ever left that room. You all were there. Just really around the clock is kind of how it seemed.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, especially when you're doing night shoots like that, like you guys have to be available. I mean, you're on set, something breaks, you suddenly have to have a replacement item, you know, or suddenly the actor's like, this isn't gonna work, you know.
Right.
As a designer, that's another part of it that makes television an interesting thing. And Grimm made it super challenging. And some people I know are up on behind the scenes with TV production and other people aren't that familiar. But as we all know, once we start shooting, we never stop. So we do an episode and then the shooting crew goes right into the next episode and then the next one and the next one. So for those of us behind the scenes, we are busy prepping that next episode or 2 episodes while the current one is shooting. And for me as a designer, I often had to be in 2 places at once because I need to go out to set to make sure that as the new episode is filming and things are going on camera for the first time, as you say, Bree, sometimes things go wrong or the weather shifts or whatever and changes need to be made. But other times you just kind of want to be there to make sure that it's working and to make sure that if somebody has a last minute thought of like, I want to add a hat or, you know, the director thinks of something, you know, I have to be there and facilitate all of that. And with Grimm, of course, we were often an hour away in some halfway up Mount Hood or out at the dam works.
Yeah, good luck.
Know.
Well, you did kind of have to toughen up as an actor. You can't get too precious when you're like an hour away and up a mountain.
Absolutely. Yeah, you guys would be out in all sorts of weather and slogging. I mean, I at least could like eventually go home. You guys were out there.
There did seem to be an unlimited supply of just like, I want this layer that's like warm, but also really thin. And can it be kind of soft? And then be Kara, be like, yep, I've got it right here.
Kara. Oh, Kara was the best.
Yeah, just taken care of and T's crossed, I's dotted in a way that I totally took for granted. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, taking care of beyond. I was that actor, Claire. What you just described, I was that person. I'm so sensitive about like fabrics and like I'm really particular about bras. I remember really stressed out about the bra. Well, then my boobs were like big, small, big, small, big, small, you know? And it's like, oh, Rosalie's like, blah. Oh my God. I remember there was something really edgy. Okay. I don't know if you remember this, but this was like well into the series and like Monroe and Rosalie are together. We're living together. We're in bed, you know, one of those many scenes where Nick calls and we're like, wake up. But I decided to not wear a bra with my white.
You did this not just like, I'm going to be.
I think we might have been in cahoots on this.
Oh, I remember talking about this.
Yes. Because I had a white t-shirt on and I was like, it's so fucking lame. When you're in bed.
In a TV episode.
In a TV episode and the actress has a bra on.
Oh, and you can see. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I thought you were talking that you were nude.
No, I mean, it was NBC at 9 on a Friday. No, but I had a white tee on.
Yes, but seeing the bra line. Oh,
no
yeah,
bra.
Yeah.
No bra.
No bra. Yeah.
But it was just between you and I. I don't think we could really talk about it with anybody.
Yeah.
Until now.
Get that out there.
We're like, now we're making an indie.
And everybody better appreciate it.
I remember, Alexandra, like you tracking, you're like, no, we're going to get you these. And then in a couple months, we'll bump you up to the next size. Like things that I just wasn't even thinking about.
But you kind of had a lot going on. I just feel like there's so many multiple layers from a costume design standpoint. So many multiple layers of being prepared just in case. You know? you never know what it could be that you're being prepared for just in case. I was thinking of other movie magic things, again, talking about Brie when you were pregnant. And again, because of always the stunts. And so you had a stunt person who was your normal size, not your pregnant size, your body double. And I remember that I designed a whole series of button front shirts for you with the idea that, you know, the collar and then the placket would be this nice straight line down the middle. That way we could have shirts in your regular size for the body double. And then we could have maternity shirts.
Yeah, expanded panels.
And a cardigan. But so that you could be comfortable and not be like, you know, but they all looked alike, sort of.
My God. I actually remembering now, I think you were like the third person that knew I was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was honestly my husband, Steve Oster, and then Alexandra.
I remember our fitting.
You were just so sweet with me and sensitive. Because you know what? It was also very early and I didn't want to talk about it and like all those things. But I almost felt like it was like a confessional because I really didn't want to talk about it with anybody.
Right.
And I was like, I might be kind of starting to gain a little weight. Just want you to know, like, plan ahead a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, costume design is always, yes, we're a support unit unlike any other.
I'm like, Alexander, I guess two questions. What was sort of the most challenging that you designed and favorite?
You know, I cannot pick favorites as far as our regular cast.
Not even Monroe. I think Monroe was a pretty fun character to dress.
Yeah. But all of you guys were fun in your own way, you know? And again, what I loved was that without making it cartoony, you all had very distinct styles, except of course when Bitsy's character became a Hexen Beast and then she kind of moved into your territory, Claire, but you at the same time were becoming the softer, gentler, non-Hexen Beast, Adeline. So there was that whole thing. But definitely, I also loved the creature aspect of it. And I was trying to come up with my favorite creature and I loved Krampus. I love Christmas. So designing Krampus was lots and lots of fun. I loved La Llorona. I think that was my first episode where I really did a big design theme and the producers kind of went, what?
Yeah,
because La Llorona was, you know, the beautiful woman in white. And I had designed this whole outfit based on like the silhouette of 15th century Spain, because that's the origin.
Yeah.
And then I had to do the crazy, creepy Rotten in the Water version, which I totally ripped off Alexander McQueen for, because it was all like some of his weirder, shredded, decayed, you know, et cetera, so that she could be underwater and turn into this monster. So I love that. I love the scalp coat guys. That was incredibly challenging.
Three enormous
men. I mean, the one guy was so big, he had a bruise on his forehead from hitting the door jamb when he came through.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, I had like a team. I had 11 people making scalp coats, and we literally were taking little pieces of leather and curing them to make it look like he'd kind of tan them and gluing hair to them. And stitching them with rawhide.
Oh, my God. That's so fun.
It's so crazy and weird.
So much work. Oh, my God.
Definitely, though, thinking about challenges, even more challenging than the scalp coat. So my work was at this really interesting intersection because I worked so closely both with the regular makeup and hair team. Of course, working with them, make sure the colors work, everything's good, the styles work with the outfit. Then we had our practical special effects team who were building all these weird appendages and masks and so forth. And then we had visual effects. And I'd done a lot of films where I worked with visual effects people, so I really understood where they were coming from. And a lot of what I would do for them was build kind of contact points on the body, because visual effects, when you're animating, is really, really a laborious process and an expensive one. So, for example, we had those manticore guys who had giant scorpion tails that popped out of their backs. Uh-huh. And so I designed this like tail size stub, a practical out of padding, so it'd be lightweight that the actor could wear when it was time to morph, so that it displaced their clothes, like their jacket would drape over it or something, so that the animator didn't have to displace the jacket.
Oh,
because
that
would have been hours and hours and hours and more work. And that way they could go and fight easily wearing something that gave the impression that something was sticking out of their clothes, though it wasn't there. And then after the fact, the visual effects guys. But that the practical makeup, we had a character, think during the first season, I need to go back and check, but who was like a king cobra.
Uh-huh.
And again, because of our very tight time frame, because it's television, our FX makeup team was amazing, but they were working down in LA. And so they'd be working to the last possible minute, getting these crazy masks and gloves and whatnot ready. And then they'd ship it up. And they had a team on the ground that would do the applications with makeup. And this cobra head showed up. And the guy had like a 31-inch neck.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And it came in at the last minute. And he was a character who had to wear a suit. And so I had to have my tailor construct a shirt collar and recut his jacket somehow.
31-inch neck.
I know. It was crazy. So that was definitely one of many exciting challenges to work with.
I wasn't even aware of that because that just never applied to my character.
That's,
you know,
what I was just going to say. It's like, right, it's always this stuff where it's like you would never think that. And I'm like, you would never even consider.
You guys had the cute morphs. You know, it was some creepy makeup for you. It was some, you know, super cute fuzzy makeup effect for you. So you guys never had to really deal with the... The wedding was crazy.
Oh, remember the wedding?
I love the wedding so much.
Oh, remember the evolution of all the wedding, like all the wedding dresses? Like that was a real journey we were on.
Oh my God, we went to all those wedding boutiques.
I like that we both were like, you know what? Rosalie is just going to be kind of glam. You know, we went through that whole, like, oh, maybe it's a little bit more vintage. Maybe it's like passed down heirloom piece, you know.
Right.
But I think it was fun that we actually like went to a bridal shop, remember, downtown, and we tried on and they gave me water, you know, and we had like a little bridal fitting.
Was it the same one we went to with Bitsy?
It was the same one.
When she was looking for her actual.
Yes, Claire.
Yes.
I remember part of what drove the vintage take, the earlier version of it, was again thinking about our visual effects. And because Rosalie was furry, I remember Steve Oster in particular being very concerned, you know, how much fur will we have to add? And will that be, like, fur on the face was super cute, but would it be creepy the or neck, would it be okay?
Like,
and in the end, we were like, we'll just kind of fade it out and it's all good. And you just get to look sexy.
I just looked good the whole episode. I was glad. Does she have like a furry decollage? Like, is that cute?
I think there was a little, I don't know. Very subtle.
Just like a little treasure trail up top.
It's kind of a boner killer. I don't know. We might be kind of went away from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This episode with the mouse hearts.
Yes.
Where it's just like seems very subtle. Like there are these characters that are wearing sort of everyday clothes, but everything is so specific. I was like thinking about just even Amanda Walsh, the sweetheart kind of neckline and that little thermal.
With the little flowers.
Then the little flowers and just, I don't know, the detail of that and how that, like what you were saying, it just like instantly gives you the information that you need.
Yeah, this was a good episode for that because it wasn't overly designed, but it's the subtle, invisible choices that, like Claire's saying, are really important in this episode.
And the other thing that was, for me, a little less subtle than usual, at least with the first two murder victims, because we had to make it very clear, you know, until you find out what's going on later in the episode, we had somebody getting attacked, and then we saw the body, and the body was an old man.
Yeah.
And we needed to make it super clear that the old man was somehow the person who'd been attacked, rather than thinking, oh, this guy got killed in the shadows, and now there's this other body. And so, especially with Lenny Drake, the first murder victim, I actually gave him kind of a more garish outfit than I would normally do. He had this bright red t-shirt. He had some very, very heavy and distinctive jewelry, like all his rings and his necklace and all this kind of stuff, so that hopefully the audience was very clear that somehow Lenny, as he died, turned into an old man.
Uh-huh.
That was the only way, the t-shirt. Yeah. Because I was even confused watching it, and that was the only way that I knew that was
the
guy.
Right, he had the t-shirt. I remember that we got him all these rings, and actually a funny behind-the-scenes story was that they had to do the drag with the stuntman several times for whatever reasons, and those rings were super ornate, but they were all sterling silver, and the stunt set actually got all the design rubbed off of them from being dragged across the garage floor a few times.
Oh, God.
But yeah, and then we had the guy that he had a garage, so he was in the coveralls with his name.
Yeah.
And, you know, just little things like that to hopefully guide the audience to understand, even though they couldn't understand what was going on because it was weird, but to help them connect the bodies. That was like a really important directive without being like, this is the same
super important. You know? I even noticed, you know, when our main mouse comes to the door of Amanda and he's got the little detail of the dirt on the corner of his jacket where he has the hoodie underneath and the canvas jacket over.
Yeah.
And just the kind of dirtiness of the edges. Like all those little details, you know, really just inform who this person is, where they come from. I mean, we're walking around all day in costume, you know, and so wardrobe is a really important tell.
Mm-hmm.
And all those little details are so cool. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Because again, that gets back to that helping us as filmmakers understand these characters that we've created and support them. And with television, one of the interesting effects of that is because of the structure of television, we have a new director for each episode. And I mean, like one of the things I loved about Grimm, and I know this happens in other shows as well, is that we kind of developed a family of directors. We had people that would come back and work with us repeatedly and that were very much part of the greater Grimm family and really, you know, tied in. But yeah, those details and the information being conveyed by the costume, it's not just going out on screen to our viewers, but it's also helping the other characters understand who these new characters are. Helping the directors go, oh, okay, you know, yes, they've got the script. We're all working from the same script. But as we know, it's the visuals that help flesh out the story and support it.
And also sustain the series. And like, that's such a good point is that with TV versus a feature, TV is a writer's medium. You know, these directors come in and yes, you run a long running show like this, you get a stable of directors and we're all creating from the same fabric. But a lot of it, you know, they're guns for hire. They come in, sometimes just one episode, sometimes two. But your part is really such an important anchor for the production process because even, you know, our producers are sometimes in LA, sometimes on scouting. Like you're really a major constant with the fabric of the narrative.
Yeah, even the DPs swap episode by episode because they get a full week off to prep the next one. And I was just realizing that as you were saying, as I was like, oh my God, yeah, I didn't even think about that, how it's doing double duty all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's really me and the production designer is in the same boat.
Yeah.
But because I'm the one that's connected to you, that's a very valid point, Bree, that I hadn't really thought about, but I sort of became the on-the-spot person with the repository of show knowledge to answer people's questions, you know?
Yeah.
By the way, all of the monsters that you designed or, you know, like the La Llorona, all that stuff, where did all of that end up?
Hopefully still in the archives at NBC Universal.
So is your Cosabella thumb.
You were wondering where that went. That's where that is. But yes, they had a massive sale, as we all know, at the end of the show to get rid of kind of like extras of things and furniture and whatnot. But every single main cast costume and all the creatures, everything heavily inventoried and photographed and sent off to Universal. And I don't believe that they display things, but maybe they will someday. I don't know, but it's all there.
I think the Rosalie corset from that circus episode, someone's taken a picture of it at some sort of office space for NBC. Which is so funny. It's like the most random thing for Rosalie.
That's true. It doesn't really connect.
It's a fun one to look at.
Yeah.
We could talk to you for 25 hours. I mean, we've had so many intimate conversations and like so many life journey, you know, just ups and downs together. And I'm just so happy that you are where you are in your life.
I can talk until the proverbial cows or monsters come home. So
we'll do it with the wine next time. We'll get into some
water. Yeah. I want to come.
I like that.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
That was just so great. And I really am reminded, Alexandra has this way, like she's so humble. She's so incredibly humble. And I hope people were able to kind of understand or at least take away of like just how much work, like how much detailed work goes into everything she does.
And never, never flustered.
Never.
Never negative.
Yeah. Never stressed, like never overtly stressed out.
No gossip, no drama.
No.
She was like steady Eddie. I mean, she worked her ass off. She's doing double duty.
Yeah.
I mean, really doing double duty.
Oh, it's just crazy. And also, like, everyone that she hired on and had around her was just, like, so uniquely positive and there to play.
I mean, you know, as actors, it's a little insidery, but, like, I mean, there's a lot of people that you become very, very intimate with. But wardrobe, it's all the idiosyncratic stuff of, like, hey, you know, my underwear is like feeling like this. Can you like go get me some different underwear? You know, you don't have time. I mean, it's also we're working for the circus and we're on a stopwatch, you know? So like you're getting naked, you're changing, you've got to go.
Yeah.
And like the wardrobe and the costume department, like they are the ones that are on set with us, especially are like in it with us.
Thank you all for being here, and we hope to catch up with you next episode.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. To be continued.